Hello and welcome to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Today we're reading from vanityfair.com. We're going to start in the Royals section, then we'll move into Hollywood, and we will end up with politics as usual. Our first headline from the Royals section, Kate Middleton and Prince William join King Charles, Queen Camilla, and other royals for Christmas at Sandringham. Prince George, Prince Charlotte, and Prince Louis walked alongside their parents on the annual stroll to services. This is by Stefania Conrary on December 26th. Though King Charles III introduced a number of new traditions for this year's royal Christmas celebration, one thing remained the same. The family's morning walk to Norfolk's St. Mary Magdalene Church continued as it has for years, with Charles and Queen Camilla leading the charge. Kate Middleton, Prince William and children, Prince Louis, Princess Charlotte, and Prince George also enjoyed the walk, which was observed on both sides by ardent fans, many bearing gifts. One such offering, a giant Lindor chocolate egg, thrilled the 7-year-old Louis, who snatched it from his father's hands. Also on the walk were Prince Edward and Duchess Sophie, along with their children, Lady Louise Mountbatten-Windsor and James, Earl of Wessex. Princess Anne, seemingly unbowed by her recent unseating as Britain's hardest working royal, walked alongside husband Sir Timothy Lawrence. Daughter Zara Tyndall and her husband Mike Tyndall were close behind. As expected, Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor was not with the family, nor was his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson. Both surprised royal watchers when they appeared with the family during the 2023 celebration, given the persistent allegations of sex abuse against Andrew, some of which he settled in 2022. Stripped of his title this fall, and with his name again in the headlines, as documents from the investigation into convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein have been released, his absence was unsurprising. But the couple's two daughters, Princess Beatrice and Princess Eugenie, were indeed in attendance, perhaps a reflection of the king's hope that they'd increase their royal profile. Also absent were Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, who celebrated elsewhere with their two children, Archie and Lilibet. Queen Camilla's two children, Tom Parker Bowles and Laura Lopes, also had noted in advance that they and their families would not join the royal family at Sandringham this year. Despite the absences, this year's celebration comes at a happy time for the family, especially given the news that King Charles is reducing his cancer treatment schedule. The year has ended on a very positive note for the king, and the good news regarding his health will undoubtedly lift his spirits and those of the people around him, royal expert Robert Jobson tells Hello. It will be good for him to have a chance to relax among his loved ones. It'll be a very special time. I'm sure he'll raise a glass this Christmas to those who care for him. Our next royal headline, Princess Anne dethroned as Britain's hardest working royal. After years clocking in at the top of the official Royal Act list, Princess Anne has been bumped to second place. This is by Diego Parado on December 24th. It's a poorly kept secret that though life as a member of Britain's royal family is marked by luxury and glamour, it's also hard work, with most days packed with official appearances and behind-the-scenes public service. No one knows this better than Canadian journalist Patricia Tebble. Every December, the author of the Right Royalty newsletter tallies up the total number of official acts that each member of the British royal family has embarked on that year, using for reference the court circular, which records of the institutional activities of King Charles III and beyond. In 2024, Princess Anne took the top slot with 433 official acts completed, despite a horseback riding injury that spurred the cancellation of her long-anticipated trip to the Newfoundland National War Museum Memorial. She was also named the hardest-working royal in 2023 when she racked up 457 official engagements. But this year, Princess Anne has dropped to second place, Tebble writes, though she was out and about even more in 2025. But though the 75-year-old had 478 engagements, she was outpaced by her brother, 77-year-old King Charles. He carried out 535 official acts, netting him this crown in addition to that other one. That uptick in activity can be viewed as a sign that his health is indeed improving, a theory bolstered by an announcement the king made earlier this month. Thanks to early diagnosis, effective intervention, and adherence to doctor's orders, my own schedule of cancer treatment can be reduced in the new year, the king said in a pre-recorded message that aired as part of Stand Up to Cancer's 2025 broadcast on the UK network Channel 4. This milestone is both a personal blessing and a testimony to the remarkable advances that have been made in cancer care in recent years. Taking third place is Charles and Anne's 61-year-old younger brother, Prince Edward, with 313 acts. His wife, 60-year-old Duchess Sophie, is ranked fourth with 235 events in 2025. At age 78, Queen Camilla is the oldest royal on the list, but is also one of the busiest, with a fifth place ranking for 228 official acts. Prince William is the heir to the throne, but the 43-year-old typically carries out fewer acts than the other members of the royal family. This year, he was ranked seventh with 202 acts. His wife, Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales, is ranked 10th on this year's list with 69 official acts. But even that number is an accomplishment worth noting for the 43-year-old royal, who announced last January that she was officially in remission following a 2024 cancer diagnosis. As anyone who has experienced a cancer diagnosis will know, it takes time to adjust to a new normal, she said then. As she returned to work, she said she would take a deliberate pace in an effort to find the right balance. And one more royal headline. Meghan Markle and Prince Harry and their children share their holiday card and a major change for their foundation. The Sussexes unveiled a rare family photo for the festive season. This is by Valentine Servant on December 19th. Meghan Markle and Prince Harry shared holiday tidings with fans worldwide to close out 2025, pairing a family photo with a simple message of warm wishes. In the photo shared Friday by the Duchess of Sussex on her Instagram account, the couple posed with their children, Prince Archie, 6, and Princess Lilibet, 4. This family portrait was taken in a verdant, sunny setting. Meghan wears an accoutred dress, a few shades off of Harry's simple white button-up shirt, and each is tenderly embracing one of their children. Archie hugs his father around the waist, and Lilibet holds her mother's hands as Meghan bends over to rub noses with her younger child. As usual, the Sussexes don't show their children's faces, which can only be seen in profile and from a distance. Happy holidays from our family to yours, the post's caption reads. On the Sussexes' official website, they share another holiday greeting. On behalf of the office of Prince Harry and Meghan, Duke and Duchess of Sussex, and Archewell, we wish you a very happy holiday season and an excellent new year. The sentiment is paired with a recap of their charitable and humanitarian activities in 2025. The couple also took the opportunity to share some new news about the organization. After 5 beautiful years, the Archewell Foundation is becoming Archewell Philanthropies. This charitable entity allows the couple and their children to expand upon their global philanthropic endeavors as a family. Archie and Lilibet also appear in the video recap. On Thanksgiving, they volunteered alongside their parents at an Our Big Kitchen Collective, which provides over 70,000 meals a year to Los Angeles residents. The family helped prepare meals that were then distributed by Mercy Housing, Pico Union Project, and PATH, groups that directly help local communities in the Sussexes' adopted home of L.A. Yesterday, Prince Harry's brother, Prince William, shared his own festive family photo on Instagram. Kate Middleton and her husband also opted for a country setting. They pose seated in the grass with their 3 children, Prince George, Princess Charlotte, and Prince Louis. We're moving to the Hollywood section. Our first headline, How Mothers on the Brink Became the Main Characters of 2025. The minds behind some of the year's buzziest maternal dysphoria stories, such as All Her Fault and If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, on bringing mommy's secrets out of the shadows and why more women are rethinking motherhood. This is by Savannah Walsh on December 26th. Mommy is stretchable. Daddy is hard, a child off-screen observes of her mother Linda, Rose Byrne, and father Charles, Christian Slater, in Mary Bronstein's If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Their child means that mommy's more like putty, a malleable form that can be shaped at one's will. The camera lingers on Linda as the assessment sinks in, her teary-eyed embarrassment quickly tempered into polite but shaky indifference. Linda, a trained therapist, will not let her pesky emotions get in the way of a good metaphor or her daughter's own counseling. Inspired by Bronstein's own experience while caring for her sick daughter, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is among a wave of films and television series released this year that grapple with maternal dysfunction, grief, and postpartum depression. That thread ran through some of 2025's most talked about movies, featuring powerful performances by Tiana Taylor in One Battle After Another, Jennifer Lawrence in Die, My Love, Jesse Buckley in Hamnet, and Amanda Seyfried in both The Testament of Anne Lee and The Housemaid. For Bronstein, the seed that the scene may have been planted when she first saw Robert Redford's 1980 film Ordinary People. Mary Tyler Moore gives one of the best performances ever of a mother in grief on screen. But since the movie is centered on the son, an Oscar-winning performance by Timothy Hutton, her grief is depicted as too much, an annoyance, getting in the way of the family moving on, Bronstein tells Vanity Fair. Where's her space to grieve? Solution of the movie is that she goes away, and then they're happy in the backyard, father and son. Even when I first saw that movie as a preteen, I was like, why is she the villain? It's a tale as old as time. A seemingly well-adjusted woman, say Meryl Streep in Kramer vs. Kramer of 1979, or Nicole Kidman in Eyes Wide Shut, 1999, expresses malaise about motherhood or marriage and then is promptly banished to the story's sidelines. As with Ordinary People, the rest of those movies are mostly devoted to the tortured, completely indulged, and thoroughly examined feelings of Kramer's Dustin Hoffman and Eyes Wide Shut's Tom Cruise. Anytime a woman in a movie is a mother, that's usually all we find out about her, says Bronstein. She's an appendage onto either the man or the child who's the center of the story. The portrayal of motherhood on shows like Leave It to Beaver and The Brady Bunch, a picket fence-lined fantasy in which women are relegated to the homestead, has been hard to shake in Hollywood, says Lucy Liu, who plays a mother in crisis in Rosemead, an indie drama inspired by a tragic true story. Women stay home and make dinner and take care of the children, while the partner is out there making money in the business suit. The pressure of that, as well as the technology that is available to children and to people in general, is kind of immersing everyone in their own world, Liu tells Vanity Fair. And that creates an identity crisis, frankly. Women are not able to do all the things and do it perfectly. There's a reality to how much one can take. That complex truth also permeated TV in 2025, as proven by Claire Danes' grieving, self-destructive novelist in The Beast in Me. Nicole Beharie, whose news anchor Chris shares her pregnancy loss on this season of The Morning Show, Murdaugh, Death in the Family, Patricia Arquette, as well as Sarah Snook and Dakota Fanning in All Her Fault, a show about one mother helping another search for her missing son. Following its premiere in November, All Her Fault became Peacock's most-watched original series launch ever within its first 3 weeks of streaming. I'm not a confident person. I worry about everything. But when it comes to this one issue, I never had any doubt. Writer, executive producer Megan Gallagher says of her show's resonance among women, "My brother-in-law's mother is a hairdresser in Columbus, Ohio. She said that several clients sit in her chairs and say, 'Have you seen All Her Fault?' If people are sitting down in their hairdressers in Columbus, Ohio and talking about the show, I think we've done well." Adapted from the author Andrea Mara's twisty mystery about a missing child, the series features Snook and Fanning as high-powered career women who feel responsible for the bulk of domestic responsibilities because of their neglectful husbands. It all stems from this idea of entitlement that men, be it Jack Lacey, who plays husband to Snook's character, or any of these monsters, anytime you're acting out that extremely, some part of you feels entitled to do so. We've never existed in a place where we can do batshit crazy stuff without being called batshit crazy, Gallagher says. It doesn't get more evil than disgraced Southern lawyer Alex Murdaugh, who in 2023 was convicted of killing his wife, Maggie, and their 22-year-old son, Paul. In the wake of serving consecutive life sentences, Murdaugh has maintained his innocence and his conviction is under appeal. Hulu's Murdaugh, Death in the Family, starring Jason Clarke as Alex, is the latest in a string of projects about the case, but the first to eradicate the idea of Maggie Murdaugh as an afterthought in her own tragedy, says Michael D. Fuller. Upon discovering that a Wikipedia page on the double homicide featured only a single line about Maggie, series co-creators Aaron Lee Carr, documentarian of Mommy Dead and Dearest fame, and Fuller, along with Arquette as star and producer, felt an opportunity for us to really explore what's the story that one sentence isn't telling. It felt like familiar terrain for Fuller, who was raised by a single mother in Southern California, only an hour away from where the Murdaughs lived. You see it with the trad wife movement, but in the South especially, it's still very ingrained. Those expectations of who within a marriage is allowed to do what, Fuller says of Alex and Maggie's fractured dynamic before her murder. When they got married, she thought she was signing up for this princessly Southern royalty lifestyle, only to endure this man-child who has monstrous appetites that continue to metastasize because you can't really ever satiate the beast, he continues. Through his attorney, Alex told People that Fuller and Carr's series mischaracterizes Alex's relationships and his wife Maggie and his son Paul, both of whom Alex loves so dearly. To that, Fuller tells Vanity Fair, "I do truly believe, to whatever extent I can understand, that he did love Maggie and Paul. I think that's one of the reasons he can't open the door of monstrousness to acknowledge what he did." In one final prescient twist, Alex used a visit to his elderly mother, Libby, then suffering from dementia, as an alibi for the murders. After the most dehumanizing, monstrous thing someone could do, he went and sat there with his mom, Fuller says. Like Alex fleeing from the darkest moments of his life and into the arms of his mother, Fuller ventures that the rocky last few years have led us back there culturally, too. We've been through so much in the past 10 years, particularly the past 5. The collective psyche has just been so traumatized, and there's so much uncertainty when we're dealing with AI, what the economy's going to look like, climate change, all these massive things, says Fuller. We dramatized Paul's older brother, Buster Murdaugh, saying at the end of his father's murder trial, "I just want my mom." There is something fundamental that a mother, in the most general way, provides. But what we're seeing with "If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You" and "Die, My Love" is the burden of that on the individual. In a year when men channeled their inner demons into vampires in Sinners, gods in Superman, and even a new Frankenstein, motherhood served as a trippy catalyst for many writer and directors. We're thinking about ourselves as mothers, but also our own mothers. If you have a good enough mother, those problems and demands and terrible feelings that we're putting forth in these movies are all behind the scenes, says Bronstein. Those are mommy's little secrets. Kids go to bed, wine comes out, or whatever it is, but we don't see that as kids. We don't see all the work that goes into even something as simple as a birthday. The unflinching portraits of maternity have had a profound effect on mothers, but also on young people deciding whether or not to procreate. Women are really openly expressing a total disinterest in marriage and children, says Gallagher, citing a recent Pew Research Center study that found a 22-point drop over the last 3 decades in teenage girls' desire to get married. As of 2025, teenage girls are officially less likely than teenage boys to say that they want to get married. So it makes sense to me that we're finally free enough, perhaps, to explore and say out loud that having kids isn't for everyone. And or you can love your kids to death and still acknowledge that the life of having kids is really hard, she continues. Could this recent spate of disillusioned mother narratives have anything to do with the United States government wreaking havoc on women's productive rights? I wouldn't say it's a hugely political show, Gallagher says, of All Her Fault, but anytime you're exploring women being unhappy and wanting other things in life, it tends to have a leftward-leaning bend, and I wish it didn't. I wish it was more universal. Bronstein, who worked on If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You for nearly a decade, added back in a candid line about her lead character, Linda, getting an abortion following an overturning of Roe v. Wade. While disclosing to her own therapist, Conan O'Brien, that she terminated her first pregnancy, Linda sobs, "I'd have a kid in college by now if I hadn't done that. Maybe I got rid of the wrong one." Bronstein, who says she is as pro-choice as they come, still thought it was important to highlight the complicated feelings that can surround an abortion. We're in a place where women are frustrated by having the choice of whether to be a mother or not taken away from them. But at the same time, in our society, having no real support once you have that baby, says Bronstein. So it's another way of communicating to women that we don't care about you. We care about you as a vessel for giving birth. But that's only the beginning of a journey that's ripe for storytelling. Everybody has a mother, whether they were good, bad, absent, present. You had a mother, says Bronstein. So why don't we center mothers in more stories? She hopes that meaningfully incorporating more complex stories of motherhood won't be too big a stretch for an industry with increasingly hard limitations. I love that there's so many female filmmakers telling their own stories for the first time, which feels ridiculous since it's 2025 and we are half the population. I'm hungry for it, and I know that other people are too, says Bronstein. I hope that if we talk about it again in 5 years, it would be like, remember we talked about how it was unusual that there was this group of movies? That's so wild. It's not unusual now. Our next headline, Bowen Yang leaves Saturday Night Live in a swirl of red wine, cocaine, and tears. For his last episode as an SNL cast member, Yang was honored by, among others, Ariana Grande, Aidy Bryant, and Cher. This is by Eve Beatty on December 21st. After nearly 7 seasons as a cast member on Saturday Night Live, Bowen Yang departed the long-standing sketch show this evening, but not before appearing in almost every sketch of the night. Hours before Ariana Grande launched into her opening monologue, the cat was out of the bag. Knowledgeable sources had tipped off Vanity Fair and others to Yang's likely exit this evening, and by Saturday morning he had confirmed the news via Instagram, writing, "I loved working at SNL, and most of all I loved the people. I was there at a time when many things in the world seemed to seem futile, but working at 30 Rock taught me the value in showing up anyway when people make it worthwhile." Yang made his debut as a member of the cast on the first episode of season 45, with Vanity Fair's Karen Valby noting then that the show's first East Asian cast member was saddled with a dispiriting first line of "What's up?" as Kim Jong-un, whom once and future President Donald Trump called for advice on getting rid of whistleblowers. But Yang quickly hit his stride, creating iconic characters such as Chinese trade rep Chen Biao, whose line, "A tariff is like a tax, but it's a little bit bitchy," was a chilling, prescient quip when uttered in 2019. With Yang's Wicked and Wicked for Good castmate Grande in the host slot for the third time Saturday, his decision to make the last SNL episode of 2025 his final turn already felt poetic in its symmetry. And then there was a musical guest, Cher, whom Yang had attempted to lure to the show for years. "I would do anything with her," Yang said of the icon in 2022. Those seated in Studio 8H were clearly clued in on tonight's news. When Yang joined Grande on stage during her monologue, a gifting frustration spin on "All I Want for Christmas Is You," the cheers threatened to drown out the singing. There was a similar uptick in audience energy when Yang, oh so briefly, appeared in a pre-taped take on Home Alone. In the SNL version, Grande's Kevin failed to remove his booby traps before his family's return, leading to, among other gory disasters, Yang's double amputation. He had way more to do in the next sketch, appearing as a try-hard dance student eager to please teachers, portrayed by Grande and soul-patched Marcello Hernandez. Their dance style, Yang explained, was cocaine then red wine. The pendulum then swung the other way in one of those sketches that served as a thinly veiled way for cast members to dust off the impressions they presumably last leveraged in their auditions. This time, it was an ad for a star-studded Christmas spectacular. Yang's contribution was a single scream for the low-hanging but still comedic idea of Yoko Ono covering a holiday tune. After Weekend Update briefly referenced Vanity Fair's bombshell interview with White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, the crowd went wild as Aidy Bryant, who left the show in 2022, and Yang brought back their beloved trend forecasters. Spoiler alert, Michael Che is still out. Sniffles were audible as Yang launched into his last sketch in which he played the soon-to-retire operator of an eggnog machine at a Delta Sky Club location. "This is my last shift," he told travelers, voice breaking, before Grande, as his wife Rhonda joined him for a duet of "Please Come Home for Christmas." And then Cher made his long-held wish come true, sailing in to play his boss at Delta. "Do you have any feedback for me?" Yang asked the Academy Award-winning actor. "Well, everyone thought you were a little bit too gay," Cher responded. "But you know what? You're perfect for me." Not a dry eye in the house. We are segueing into the politics section, but these actually come from the culture section of Vanity Fair. The first headline, "What the Epstein Files Say About the Dark, Rotten Trappings of Wealth." The release of the Epstein Files provides thousands of images of his multi-million dollar homes and international vacations, painting an unsettling picture of his dark decadence. This is by Elise Taylor on December 23rd. While many of the Epstein files released by the Department of Justice on Friday were heavily redacted, the government shared thousands of clear, unobstructed photographs. They paint a somewhat disjointed picture of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein's travels, belongings, and lavish homes through the lens of case-building federal investigators who snapped pictures of everything they thought might be relevant in the eyes of the law. Out of context, Much of what they captured seems in line with the lifestyle of the wealthy in New York City. Designer clothing, impressive art. Yet with the dark shadow of Epstein's horrendous crimes, they show how these trappings of wealth ensnared others. The main setting? His Manhattan townhouse on East 71st Street, which sold for $51 million in March of 2021. Coincidentally, the home is around 51,000 square feet. It is the definition of opulence. Crystal chandeliers, sprawling Persian carpets, a lacquered desk that Epstein would tell people once belonged to J.P. Morgan. There's a staircase with a decorative wrought iron balustrade railing, a bedroom with bold flower wallpaper, and in what appears to be an entryway, Rococo gilt wood mirrors. In a 2003 story on Epstein, Vanity Fair reported that Epstein worked with French decorator Alberto Pinto, whose clients included the royal families of Jordan and Saudi Arabia. The photograph showed a bidet in one bathroom, a fancy Japanese toilet in another. In a closet hang several puffer jackets, including one with the instantly distinguishable Canada Goose patch. The photographs show a book collection that is eccentric and bizarrely wide-ranging, like that of a man trying to seem like the smartest and most interesting person in the room. There are titles on Chinese calligraphy, Greek mythology, and Baroque art. One shelf held The Great Shoots, a chronicle of Britain's grandest game-shooting estates, and the Victor Book of the Opera, a famous historic guide to 110 operas that was originally published in 1912. At the end table has a copy of the Modern Poetic Sequence under a picture of Albert Einstein. Tucked away within those esoteric literary titles is one called Yoga for Men. I'm going to pause here to remind you that you're listening to the Vanity Fair Hour on Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. We are in the middle of an article from vanityfair.com about Jeffrey Epstein and his wealth. The collection also fits the definition of odd. Photos showed a taxidermied dog in a corner and a tiger in another. One room held a sculpture of a lion devouring an antelope. There was a 9-foot ebony Steinway D grand piano, which Epstein was known to play for guests. On his private island of Little St. James, there was what appeared to be a dental office adorned with tribal masks. Odd isn't a strong enough word for some of Epstein's other decor choices. A life-size sculpture of a bride hung in the hallway as if from the gallows, and there was the massage room. The word massage became code for sex, Virginia Giuffre, one of Jeffrey Epstein's victims, said in a 2016 deposition, which was part of a defamation lawsuit she brought against Ghislaine Maxwell in 2015. The case was settled in 2017. This decadent distributor lifestyle extended far beyond the confines of Epstein's multi-million dollar property portfolio, which included the Upper East Side townhouse, the private island, a waterfront home on Palm Beach Island, and an estimated 7,500-acre ranch in New Mexico. Grand, labyrinth-like homes that one could first could imagine never wanting to leave, and then later finding out they actually couldn't. More photos show Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, who is currently serving 20 years in prison for conspiring with Epstein to sexually abuse and traffic underage girls, often vacationing abroad. There they are, outside Le Goriot restaurant in Saint-Tropez, France, arguably one of the most famous summer destinations for billionaires in the world. Epstein wears a Villebrequin t-shirt. Other photos show them on a trip for which they took a helicopter chartered from Air Monaco, where they posed for pictures by a vineyard. More images show them frolicking around St. Bart's, where villas can regularly rent for hundreds of thousands of dollars per week. And then there's the yacht trip, where Epstein was photographed taking off his shoes aboard the vessel, the Huntress. Within a swirl of earlier declassified material is Epstein's address book, whose contents was first published by journalist Nick Bryant in 2019. In the back, Epstein kept a carefully curated list of hotels, restaurants, and stores. There were no hidden gems, holes in the walls, or up-and-coming locations. Instead, it was filled with places that exclusively and famously catered to a global set of millionaires and billionaires who sought to see and be seen. There's an entry for Manhattan's Four Seasons restaurant, the famous Power Lunch Spot, now permanently closed, in the Seagram building that had a James Rosenquist mural and was frequented by Bill Clinton and Henry Kissinger. For dinner, he had a phone number for Mr. Chow, where models, socialites, and other moneyed New Yorkers would drink lychee martinis and eat Peking duck while racking up sky-high bills. Hotels were exclusively five-star and famous for their over-the-top fanciness. The Mark in New York, the Beverly Hills Hotel in Los Angeles, and Plaza Athénée in Paris. There's even an entry for the secretive Corvilia Ski Club in Switzerland, whose membership once included Coco Chanel. A mention in Jeffrey Epstein's Black Book doesn't mean something untoward or illegal happened there, or even that he frequented those places, but they do suggest a gilded existence where gold on the outside hid a cheap, dark metal beneath. Investigators took thousands of photos of Epstein's compound on Little St. James, where some of the most egregious crimes are said to have taken place. One of them shows a shower. There's a bottle of Frederick Fekkai shampoo, an expensive hair care product from the luxury salon, yet also on the shelf, a bottle of Head & Shoulders. Amid all rare antiques, the extensive art, fancy amenities, was a creepy, cruel man with dandruff shampoo. Next up, it's a turning point. Nicki Minaj has a MAGA coming out party with Erica Kirk at America Fest. At Turning Point USA's annual gathering, Minaj talked about her affection for Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, and Kirk breezed past an awkward assassin joke by Aaron Vanderhoof on December 22nd. On Sunday morning, Nicki Minaj joined Turning Point USA CEO Erica Kirk as a surprise guest at the right-wing organization's annual America Fest. On stage, the rapper tried to give the conservative movement something for which it has long been desperate, the cultural upper hand. "We're the cool kids," Minaj said, gesturing to the audience. "The other people, they're the ones who are still just disgruntled, but really they're just disgruntled with themselves." Kirk began the conversation with a comment that pointed to the memory of her husband, Charlie Kirk, who was shot and killed during a public event on September 10th. "Charlie was very good about having a surprise for every AmFest," she said before turning to Minaj. "We are so blessed to have you. We're so grateful." She then asked Minaj to do a dramatic reading of her recent posts about California Governor Gavin Newsom, a potential 2028 contender and one of the weekend's main conservative bogeymen. After obliging, the rapper started a riff by adding some new insults. "Dear new scum," Minaj said, "we don't have a problem cleaning up the scum if we have to. Please tread lightly. That's what I would say to Gavi Poo." In certain ways, choosing Minaj as a surprise guest was a baffling homage. Though Charlie apparently enjoyed Minaj's music, he wasn't a fan of what she stood for. During the 2024 debate with a student, he said that neither Minaj nor Cardi B was a good role model for 18-year-old black girls. But that was before Minaj began her rightward migration, a political journey that began amid the pandemic with skeptical tweets about COVID vaccines, including one alleging negative effects on her cousin's friend's testicles, and has concluded with effusive praise for President Donald Trump. Last month, Minaj made her support for the MAGA movement official when she accepted an invitation from Mike Waltz, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, to deliver a speech at the UN's U.S. headquarters. On November 18th, she spoke up about the alleged persecution of Nigerian Christians, a Trump-favored issue. Ever since, she's been alternately retweeting fans and making posts complimentary of Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. Minaj, for the record, said last year that she is not a U.S. citizen, meaning she can't vote in federal elections. During her conversation with Kirk on Sunday, Minaj claimed that her metamorphosis started with a religious reawakening after her time in the music industry pulled her away from Christianity. Like, if you haven't seen a long-lost friend for a long time and then you bump into them again, that's how it's been feeling for me, she said, just going back to God and praying and talking to him. She added that she also doesn't like the current political climate. People are no longer using their minds, their brains. So right now, just imagine we're not allowed to have a different opinion anymore. We're not allowed to think out loud anymore. This is not what the world used to feel like. On stage, Minaj tripled down on praising both Trump and Vance. I love both of them. They're both powerful men, smart, strong, all of that, she said. Both of them have a very uncanny ability to be someone that you can relate to. I can relate to them. When I hear them speak, I know that they're one of us. Minaj was attempting to praise the pair's looks when she made a strange comment. Dear young men, you have amazing role models like our handsome, dashing president, she said. You have amazing role models like the assassin J.D. Vance, our vice president. Almost immediately, Minaj seemed to remember that she was appearing with a woman whose husband was recently assassinated. She tensed up and put her hand to her mouth. But Kirk immediately jumped in to brush off any offense. Trust me, there's nothing new under the sun that I have not heard, so you're fine, she told Minaj. I love you. I love you. You have to laugh about it, truly. I've been called every single thing, and you know what? God is so good, you'll let it roll off your back. The brief acknowledgement of Kirk's painful situation was a moment of uncomfortable grief in a weekend full of them. Throughout America Fest, which ran from Thursday to Sunday, Turning Point USA tried to memorialize its founder as a newly minted Christian martyr. Inside the Phoenix Convention Center, the organization set up a tent identical to the one under which Charlie was shot at Utah Valley University. The display stayed up all weekend, functioning as a spot where fans could pay homage and take selfies. During the event, Kirk also sat in front of a TPUSA tour bus to imitate the Prove Me Wrong debates, for which her husband often went viral. Though MS Now, Brandi Zadronzi, noted that no one came to challenge her. Instead, admirers asked kind questions. Erica's answers, which sometimes rambled, Zadrozny wrote, included stories about her husband and insights into biohacking, divine timing, vitamin C, the dangers of Botox, her two small children, and her grief, which felt heavy in the room. None of these issues came up when Kirk spoke to Minaj. Instead, the focus was on the rapper and her opinions about culture. At one point, Minaj began to speak about representation and making all people feel beautiful, common concepts in the more diversity-friendly 2010s when Minaj first got famous. Then she shifted gears, blaming the media for making young black children feel proud of themselves, but at the same time telling other children not to be proud of themselves. She added, "No, that's not how it works. I don't need someone with blonde hair or blue eyes to downplay their beauty because I know my beauty." It was an awkward moment, but at least one person in the audience was paying attention. On Monday morning, Vance, who made headlines of his own with an America Fest speech in which he crowed that in the United States of America, you don't have to apologize for being white anymore, went on social media to praise Minaj's similar message. Nicki Minaj said something at AmFest that was really profound, he wrote. I'm paraphrasing, but she said, "Just because I want little black girls to think that they're beautiful doesn't mean I need to put down little girls with blonde hair and blue eyes. We all got wrapped up over the last few years in zero-sum thinking. This was because the people who think they rule the world pit us against one another. More about Turning Point. At Turning Point USA's America Fest, the Epstein files landed with a thud. The crowd at the annual gathering thrown by Charlie Kirk's conservative group hardly seemed to notice the release. Why? Without trust and accountability, even explosive disclosures fall flat, said one commentator. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on December 20th. Not so long ago, the release of thousands of documents related to Jeffrey Epstein, replete with embarrassing photos of Bill Clinton and other celebrities, would have set a TPUSA conference ablaze. We're in a different time now. Most of America Fest, an annual gathering of the right thrown by the conservative youth group founded by Charlie Kirk, received the latest release of a trove of Epstein files with outright indifference. I didn't see the new release, said one attendee wearing a red MAGA hat. The Friday before Christmas and no one cared, joked another. Oh, they did? Responded a third. When I explained the new revelations, they were dismissive. Whoever died on Epstein Island, who was taken advantage of, there's more people in your neighborhood Planned Parenthood being put to death, said one. On Friday, Donald Trump's Justice Department released more than 13,000 documents relating to investigations into Epstein, the notorious financier and sex criminal who died by suicide while awaiting trial for trafficking minors in 2019. The partial release, compelled by an order from Congress, was heavily redacted. It included a conspicuous number of photos of Clinton, with little sight of Trump, leading critics to accuse the administration of selective release and redaction. Epstein's victims quickly expressed their fury over what they said was an inadequate disclosure. Trump is mentioned in the dump. One document, which has been previously reported, details an alleged interaction between a child who accused Epstein of abuse and Trump. The girl, who is not identified, claimed that in 1994, when she was 14, Epstein brought her to Mar-a-Lago. This is a good one, right? Epstein told Trump when he introduced the two, according to the girl. Trump, she said, smiled and nodded in agreement. The headliners at the TPUSA conference held in Phoenix this week made no mention of the new documents. The only reference to the late sex criminal came Thursday night when Ben Shapiro, in a diatribe against Steve Bannon, pointed out that he served as a PR agent for Jeffrey Epstein. Eric Bolling, the conservative commentator and longtime Trump ally, told me the Trump base was tuning out of the Epstein story because trust has been exhausted. One side stopped trusting institutions a long time ago, and the other keeps waiting for them to deliver, he said. Transparency was promised for years. What people got was a slow drip of useless distractions. Without trust and accountability, even explosive disclosures fall flat. For years, a large faction of Trump's supporters alleged the existence of so-called Epstein files, which they believed to be a trove of documents that would expose a vast network of elite pedophiles carrying out various crimes. Trump and members of his administration fueled those theories, and the base ate it up, until he was elected president, at which point he mounted a campaign, both publicly and privately, to resist the release of documents related to Epstein. Many obeyed Trump's orders to move on from the Epstein controversy, notably Charlie Kirk himself. Honestly, I'm done talking about Epstein for the time being, he said in July. I'm going to trust my friends in the administration. Susie Wiles, the White House chief of staff, revealed in interviews with Vanity Fair published this week that she did not see the Epstein issue as an important one for the MAGA base. The people that are inordinately interested in Epstein are the new members of the Trump coalition, she said. It's the Joe Rogan listeners. It's the people that are sort of new to our world. It's not the MAGA base. Yet the about-face confused and devastated many of Trump's most fervent supporters, including high-profile names like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Last month, Greene told me she believed the Trump administration was engaged in a cover-up. My suspicion and question is, has stuff been destroyed, she asked. I just can't help but ask that. And will the public ever really know? People are perturbed that nobody else has been found guilty, veteran pro-Trump activist Blake Marnell, also known as Brickman, owing to his predilection for wearing a suit of bricks to signal his support for Trump's border wall, told me at America Fest. It makes no sense. The administration's resistance has been challenged by members of Congress and news outlets that have worked assiduously to uncover more of what the government knows about Epstein. This week, the New York Times published an explosive exposé revealing the extent of Epstein and Trump's close friendship and their exploits with women. The Times did not find evidence that implicated Trump in Epstein's abuse of minors, but the reporting debunked claims from Trump's spokespeople that the two were never close. Despite all this, it's not hard to see why the MAGA faithful are no longer enthralled by the Epstein files. The theories were fun until peeling the onion revealed Trump at its center. Their worst-case scenario is that Trump has been leading a cover-up of pedophiles' crimes. The best-case scenario, according to America Fest attendees I surveyed on Friday, is that the Trump administration has bungled the issue and needs to swiftly embrace transparency again. The perception that they've botched the release made it all the more bizarre that on Friday, Trump's press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, proudly reposted Epstein files photos of Clinton on X, taking the least self-aware victory lap imaginable. Trump demonstrated more humility than his aides. At a rally Friday night, he didn't mention Epstein once. Not all Trump supporters are buying it. People are raging and walking away, Green wrote online, criticizing the heavy redactions and partial release. They covered up the Epstein files, wrote Owen Schroyer, a former InfoWars host who Trump pardoned for his role in the January 6 riot. No other way to put it now. They've had years to protect victims, including now plenty of time in this administration. They are all complicit, media and administration included. Pedo protection racket. For those left unsatisfied, the battle for transparency is far from over. Democrat Ro Khanna and Republican Thomas Massie, the congressman leading the charge to compel the release of the Justice Department files, responded furiously to Friday's dump. Massie said it grossly fails to meet the legal obligations spelled out by their Epstein Transparency Act. The Epstein files have to be released, said 19-year-old Nick Parise, a Trump supporter in a red MAGA hat whom I spoke with inside the convention center on Friday night. And we the people have a right to know who was on it, be it President Trump, be it Republicans, be it Democrats. Up next, the real reason Trump keeps ranting about Venezuelan oil. It could be that he's just trying to destabilize Nicolas Maduro's regime. Though even that explanation, says one expert, is very confusing. I don't see a strategy here. This is by Chris Smith on December 23rd. Donald Trump loves to huff and puff about oil. Way back in 2011, when United States troops were finally exiting Iraq, Trump insisted that if it were up to him, he would take the oil on the way out. 5 years later, when Trump was running for president, he repeated the petroleum grab idea with the dubious claim that it would deprive ISIS of revenue. Now, as Trump ramps up military pressure on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, he rants both out loud, "They took all of our oil and we want it back," and less coherently, online, "America will not allow a hostile regime to take our oil, land, or any other assets, all of which must be returned to the United States immediately." The oil trades seem to deliver a perfect aha moment. See, the Trump administration's campaign against Venezuela, which has drawn outrage for bombing boats that were allegedly smuggling drugs, wasn't really about stopping the flow of narcotics. It was about imperialism and profiteering. That explanation made factual sense. Venezuela is a relatively minor player in the U.S. drug trade, and losing a few small boats in the Caribbean Sea was unlikely to cause Maduro any real concern, despite what Trump's chief of staff, Susie Wiles, told Vanity Fair's Chris Whipple in November. He wants to keep on blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle, and people way smarter than me on that say he will. The oil motive also tracked with Trump's character. Money and attention are the only two things he truly cares about, so seizing Venezuela's most valuable export would be fittingly kleptocratic. Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader and a Nobel Peace Prize winner, clearly believes that the way to Trump's heart is through his wallet. In February, she appeared on Donald Trump Jr.'s podcast to tout Venezuela's infinite potential for U.S. companies and has talked up the country as a $1.7 trillion opportunity. In 2023, President Trump promised to take on the cartels and protect our homeland from narco-terrorists trying to kill Americans with illicit narcotics. The entire administration is working cohesively to deliver the president's agenda to keep this poison out of our communities, says Deputy White House Press Secretary Anna Kelly in an email response. But Trump's fixation on Venezuela, and more specifically the way he's talking about seizing the nation's resources, could be more strategic than it seems, in service of a goal that isn't as obvious as either national or personal enrichment. He has delivered his bombast in tandem with a naval blockade targeting tankers that were violating international sanctions, a move that could quickly have a substantial impact. The Maduro regime's big money comes from exporting oil on the black market, says James B. Story, who was the U.S. ambassador to Venezuela from 2018 to 2023 under both Trump and Joe Biden. 40% of that oil, he says, is exported either via ghost fleet, ships that use sketchy identification to smuggle goods, or sanctioned vessel, ships bound for countries under U.S. sanctions, such as Iran. Limiting the black market exports would in turn affect Venezuela's ability to export oil legitimately. As the black market vessels get shut down or turned away, says Story, they're going to have a problem very soon, perhaps within a week or two, of no longer having storage capacity. And if you don't pump it, you destroy the machinery, meaning that nobody gets oil, regardless of the means of delivery. Story and other experts believe that Trump's oil rhetoric is really about amplifying those practical problems, thereby intimidating the Venezuelan elites who profit from Maduro's reign and consequently undermining his support. That line of thinking is even more plausible when you consider a large irony. American oil companies, which would have the most to gain from a conflict that allowed seizure of Venezuelan resources, seems unenthusiastic about returning to Venezuela anytime soon. Most of them left the country in 1976 when its industry was nationalized by President Carlos Andrés Pérez, a democratic socialist. Only Chevron, which currently does business under a limited U.S. operating license, has stayed. Now, with worldwide oil prices low and American oil production surging, a shift that began during Joe Biden's presidency, U.S. companies don't appear to be clamoring to follow Trump's belligerent lead on Venezuela. We're not needy anymore, says Victoria Coates, who was a senior advisor on the National Security Council and in the Energy Department during Trump's first term. That changes all of our energy relationships. We are no longer a supplicant in the Gulf. We are a potentially friendly competitor. Maduro is plenty corrupt, and he has exported chaos, embodied most dramatically in the millions of Venezuelans who have fled their country in the past decade. Clamping down on immigration has, of course, also been a pillar of Trump's agenda. But the choice to go after Maduro aggressively, one expert believes, looks more like the product of an internal power struggle than a decision born of true desire for oil dominance. Early in the administration, there were two camps lobbying the president regarding Venezuelan policy, says Francisco Mora, a Latin American affairs expert who was Biden's ambassador to the Organization of American States. The Rick Grenell faction wanted to somehow negotiate with Maduro and get concessions. Marco Rubio and Stephen Miller were more interested in regime change. The latter is the camp that's currently holding sway over the president, at least for now. That could change, especially if the president starts getting tired of not seeing the outcome he wants, Mora says. He is, as you know, transactional, and he might want to negotiate with Maduro. But it's very confusing. I don't see a strategy here. That muddle is making a dangerous situation even more potentially volatile. Wiles conceded to Whipple that Trump couldn't attack targets on Venezuela's mainland without congressional approval. If he were to authorize some activity on land, then it's war. Then we'd need Congress. Even so, right now, tens of thousands of American troops are massed off the coast of Venezuela, and a slight provocation could spark lethal consequences. For a man who wants a peace prize, he certainly wants to be in charge of a major conflict and show America's power, and might in a way that most Americans would not agree with it being used currently, says Congresswoman Betty McCollum, a Minnesota Democrat who has opposed Trump's Venezuelan actions on moral, fiscal, and national security grounds. I have a lot of people who are very, very fearful that Cuba could be next. If Maduro is deposed, violently or not, and the Trump administration doesn't have a workable plan for what comes next in rebuilding Venezuela, beyond taking back the oil, the longer-term prospects are also alarming. I would say, with very cautious optimism, that this would be a better situation than in Iraq or Afghanistan, Coates says, but there is always a worse monster, and anybody who tells you no is lying. Our next headline, Barry Weiss's 60-minute stumble follows private rejection from Megyn Kelly. Before she stoked outrage by shelving a 60-minute segment about a notorious El Salvador prison, Weiss spent weeks lobbying Megyn Kelly to participate in a debate on feminism with Call Her Daddy host Alex Cooper, to no avail. This is by Aidan McLaughlin on December 23rd. Dismal, confused, demoralized, super fucked. That, as one reporter tells Vanity Fair, is the mood inside CBS News this week, all because of Barry Weiss, about 14 minutes of television that criticized the Trump administration and a Canadian streaming service of all things. Over the weekend, CBS News' controversial new editor-in-chief abruptly pulled a 60-minute segment featuring interviews with several Venezuelan migrants sent by the Trump administration to CECOT, a notorious prison in El Salvador, without trial. Her decision caused an uproar both inside the network and online. Then the report was mistakenly uploaded by a Canadian network, allowing anyone with Wi-Fi to see the segment Weiss had tried to shelve. I mean, it's already out there, so now we just look like idiots, the CBS reporter tells me. A representative for CBS News did not respond to Vanity Fair's request for comment. The controversy is the latest in a series of hurdles for CBS News under Weiss, who was handpicked by the new Paramount Skydance boss, David Ellison, to serve as the outlet's editor-in-chief earlier this year after Paramount acquired The Free Press, a successful digital media startup she co-founded. Before announcing a new CBS town hall and debate series, Weiss, according to two sources, spent weeks lobbying Megyn Kelly to participate in a debate on feminism with Call Her Daddy host Alex Cooper, to no avail. Sources close to Cooper say she had not been invited to the proposed debate. This was before Weiss promoted Ben Shapiro's broadside against Kelly at Turning Point's annual conference, triggering a searing response from the conservative commentator. Barry, for all of her proselytizing about how bad cancel culture is, has not been canceled, Kelly told me in an interview over the weekend. She's only ever been given opportunity after opportunity, and as she gets more powerful, she wants more and more censorship on her signature issue, which is Israel. CBS announced that the CECOT segment would not run just hours before 60 Minutes was set to air on Saturday night. In a scathing internal memo, Sharon Alfonsi, the longtime 60 Minutes correspondent who reported the segment, objected to the decision. Our story was screened 5 times and cleared by both CBS attorneys and Standards and Practices, she wrote in the Sunday memo, which was quickly leaked to several media reporters, per the New York Times. It is factually correct. In my view, pulling it now, after every rigorous internal check has been met, is not an editorial decision. It is a political one. In a different memo sent to 60 Minutes leadership on Sunday, Weiss argued, per Axios, that the piece was not ready. At present, we do not present the administration's argument for why it sent 252 Venezuelans to CECOT, she wrote. The segment that aired in Canada featured sound bites from White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt, President Donald Trump, and Secretary of Homeland Security Kristi Noem. In it, Alfonsi said the Department of Homeland Security declined our request for an interview and referred all questions about CECOT to El Salvador. The government there did not respond to our requests. Critics of Weiss have argued that it's not clear what further comment from the administration would add. Trump officials have refused to say what specific crimes the men sent to CECOT committed. Leavitt said from the White House that the men were heinous monsters, rapists, murderers, kidnappers, sexual assaulters, predators. But according to Alfonso's reporting, at least 48.8% of the men had no criminal history. Internal DHS data reported by the Texas Tribune earlier this year showed that the U.S. government knew the vast majority of Venezuelans sent to CECOT had not been convicted of crimes in the United States before it labeled them as terrorists and deported them. During the network's editorial call on Monday morning, Weiss expressed frustration with this turn of events. The only newsroom I'm interested in running is one in which we are able to have contentious disagreements about the thorniest editorial matters, with respect, and crucially, where we assume the best intent of our colleagues, she said. Anything else is absolutely unacceptable. This brings us to the end of our time here on the Vanity Fair Hour. Once again, you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Amy Smith. I'm your volunteer broadcaster for this program. Thank you for listening, and I invite you to join me next week for another full hour of stories from vanityfair.com. Thank you for listening. Happy New Year, and we'll see you next week.